The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. There is a cave in Belize that goes on for about a kilometre and a half. And at the end lies the Crystal Maiden, the remains of a Mayan human sacrifice. We'll be hearing the magnificent story in a few minutes' time. But first, we're going to kick off things with a look back at the week's science news. And joining us via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Lara Duncan. You're both very welcome. Our first story. It's rather timely, Lara, because it was a full moon last night, or it felt like a full moon last night. Incredible brightness out there if you were out at all.
It's been actually the most beautiful few days of a full moon, really, really, really gorgeous. And this is actually a story that's come out of two different universities, one in Buenos Aires and in collaboration with the University of Washington. And what they looked at was how people's sleep patterns vary with the lunar cycle. So the lunar cycle is 29.5 days, and we have what we know as a full moon to be a full moon. And then on the opposite end, we have what we call the new moon. And they used wrist monitors on 98 people in three indigenous communities in Argentina. Very interestingly, one of these communities was an urban community that lived with electricity. But the two other communities, one lived entirely without electricity and one lived with very limited electricity.
Wow.
So what they wanted, I know, and to be honest, that I found that initially one of the most fascinating parts of the study. And what they did was they measured these people over 1 to 2 months, just depending, to see what time they went to bed at and how long they slept for. And what they found with a good amount of consistency was that in the 3 to 5 days leading up to a full moon, so just prior to the full moon, and when the moonlight is brightest earlier in the evening, people went to bed an awful lot later, in some cases up to 80 minutes later in some of the communities. And they slept for 20 to 90 minutes less. So again, up to 90 minutes less. And that's an hour and a half less. This is a huge amount less. And they found, quite interestingly, and I suppose maybe logically, that the people with no electricity were the most acutely aware of the moon cycle, essentially, and they were the ones that went to bed later when the moon was brighter. But this held true for the people who have full electricity and theoretically should be almost removed from the effects of a lunar cycle. Huh. And just to see if this followed through, because a lot of these people from a lower socioeconomic background, so they did the same study in 464 students in Seattle, and again they just found the same thing. People seem to be acutely affected in terms of when they go to bed and the length that they sleep by the fullness of the moon. I just think it's really interesting.
What was the percentage of werewolves in the cohort community?
I think they found it at 1.7%, but that wasn't DNA tested.
It was, and I suppose that wouldn't have been a significant enough group if you're talking about...
Exactly, you know what, just not important enough.
I mean, don't we already know this? Or is this new? I thought everybody knew the moon affected our sleep patterns. Is that something we didn't know until now? It was never proven until now?
No, you're right. It was definitely, lots of studies have shown it. I suppose the interesting thing in this is it's showing that it's not actually the full moon. It's the days prior to the full moon. So by the full moon, people's oscillation patterns had tended to go back to their baseline.
Right.
So I suppose that's the interesting thing. It's when the moon is brighter earlier in the evening. So you're right. It's not brand new information, but it's the timing of it that is really quite interesting. But I think overall, the fact that we are in any way linked to the lunar cycle is just absolutely fascinating. Why are we? I mean, they found no causality. So I suppose that's important to say, that the researchers themselves can't proffer a theory on why people who live with full electricity are still linked to this lunar cycle. And they didn't look at things like circadian clocks and more internal factors. But it's still, I just think it's, you know, why? Why are we still linked to the moon?
Science, that's why.
And werewolves.
Thanks, Shane.
So lucky we have him here, isn't it?
All right. I think it's very interesting. Your thoughts on that, please. And does the moon affect you? You can text us in 53106, or you can email us science@newstalk.com, or you can howl. Exactly. We'd love to hear your thoughts. The second story, Shane, has to do with how to make pure oxygen.
Yeah. And as Lara knows, I'm no doctors, but she has told me reliably that you do need oxygen to breathe. So it's very necessary. The physicist in me knows you also need it to make steel. And if we had a lot more of it, we could use it to sequester carbon dioxide and bury it in the ground. So it's very handy, but it's incredibly expensive to make. And at the moment, what we do is we liquefy air and then we distill off the components and we then turn the liquid oxygen back into a gas. And that's used predominantly by medics. But as I said, it's quite expensive to make it. And there has been a lot of interest in some new work that's been done in Colorado by a company to separate air into oxygen, nitrogen, etc., using magnets and a magnetic approach, which is very, very cool. So what they do is they rely on the fact that oxygen is slightly magnetic. Now, it's not...
Is it?
Yeah, it's not possible to magnetize it as you can, say, iron or something like that. But it does react to magnetic fields, albeit very weakly. And so if you pump air into a room that has strong magnets, the oxygen would be slightly more dense denser as you approach the magnet. But it's a small effect. And so what this company have done in Colorado is they have worked out a more efficient way to separate the air using magnets. They pass air through something called a microchannel, which is about a tube that's about a diameter of 1 millimeter. So it's very small. They choose a really small diameter to achieve something called laminar flow, which means that you're getting an airflow through it with no turbulence. So in other words, there's no mixing.
We talked about laminar flows on the program, and the laminar flows and turbulence is actually a fascinating subject. If you want to listen back to the podcast, it's on newstalk.com in the futureproof section. Like, if we didn't have turbulence, our heads would melt and our feet would freeze. And actually, the turbulence of air is vital, because laminar flows in one direction along straight lines, is a very interesting phenomenon, but doesn't happen in the natural world very often.
Yeah, and it's really complex mathematically to model it. I know that from my undergrad days, pulling my hair out doing it. But they pass air through these microchannels. They put a magnet on one side of it, and it preferentially pulls the oxygen up toward it. And so you can separate the gas. Now, each sort of channel is actually quite inefficient. It only has a 0.1% yield. So you're talking tiny effects. And they reckon they could get that up to about 0.5%. But what they're proposing to do is cycle the air repeatedly through lots of these micro channels. And they reckon that after 30 cycles, they'd be able to produce oxygen that's 90% pure. And that would be useful for people like Lara, who work on wards where they have to give patients oxygen through ventilators, etc. So it's a whole new way of producing pure oxygen.
I had no idea oxygen was magnetic. Fascinating. Thanks, Shane. Our third story, Lara, has to do with machine learning.
Yeah, that's exactly it, Jonathan. I suppose I feel like we've talked about artificial intelligence more and more on the show as the years have gone on. And this is, again, the use of artificial intelligence in medicine. And this is a study that came out of the University of Alberta, and it's a study on schizophrenia. So schizophrenia is a psychiatric disease where people have delusions or hallucinations or disorganized speech. And one of the interesting but very sad facts is that first degree relatives of people with schizophrenia have actually got a nearly 20% risk of developing the disease themselves. So first degree relative is mum, dad, brother, sister, or one of your children. But in the general population, the risk is only about 1%. So they took 57 healthy first degree relatives of people with schizophrenia, and they put them through a functional MRI machine, and they used artificial intelligence to assess who they thought would be the ones most at risk of having a diagnosis of schizophrenia in the future. And they also gave them what we call a self-reported schizotypal personality trait scale, and these people answered it themselves. And the AI was able to identify the 14 people who also had the highest score on this schizotypal personality trait scale. So it's just really interesting that the AI is able to identify the people that I suppose medicine would argue might be the most at risk of developing this disease. It sort of also slightly screams a Tom Cruise Minority Report style thing. And I know that is a bit scary, but importantly, nobody is ever going to be diagnosed with schizophrenia, certainly in the modern world, without, you know, extensive psychiatric assessment. But I suppose the point is to have an idea of who's at risk, maybe early diagnosis, and study the disease process. So it's just another of the many examples of AI being used in medicine.
Yeah, and
that terrifies me.
Well, but it's really, really useful when you have limited resources, such as counselling services that we as we have in this country, for people to go get an assessment and for people to realise, okay, you're more at risk. Early intervention, recognising problems before they become a problem, and addressing that behaviour with that person while those symptoms have not yet arisen, that is a hugely useful thing in medicine. If you could do that across the board, we would all have free healthcare and we wouldn't have to pay insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we have to be practical as well. MRI machines don't grow out of trees, and getting someone into a functional MRI is extremely difficult, and potentially there are far better uses for that time. But in a practical way, you're absolutely right. There's a huge role for AI, especially in diagnosis in terms of radiology, looking at scans, looking at cells, those kind of things. And you're right, the more we develop it, the better it will be for people and for patients.
But it's an MRI now, right? It's an MRI now, but it may be another a form of diagnostic test in the future that is
Absolutely.
Much more accessible. And that's the point. Our final story, Shane, has to do with dogs.
It does, absolutely.
There isn't a dog paper we haven't covered in the past 10 years because of Shane's obsession.
And yours, and Lara's. So it turns out you can teach an old dog new tricks, words at least. And so this is building on a lot of work that we have spoken about on the programme. And they have figured out that one of the best or most efficient ways to teach a dog is using play, which, funnily enough, is one of the best ways to teach children or adults how to do new things. So we've spoken before about collies in particular that have been very clever. They could learn the names of 200 or 1,000 objects, depending on who you're looking at in the collie world. And this new work has, as I said, suggested that introducing play is a very efficient way for them to learn new words. And this is work that was done in Hungary. And what they did was they found two very clever doggies. So they have a kind of a track record of being able to learn things, a Border Collie and a Yorkshire Terrier. And what they did was they gave them 8 toys each, 7 of which they knew and 1 was new. And when they were asked to go and find or fetch each of the objects, the one that they didn't know, they were able to infer because it was the missing one. In other words, they were able to identify the new object because they knew the names of all the rest. But that's not the exciting thing. It's because when they added a second new toy, in other words, 6 things they knew and 2 that they had never seen before, the dogs weren't able to distinguish between the 2 new objects. So that was a limitation. However, they then repeated the experiment with a whole new bunch of objects. And they found that if they got the dogs to play with the new toys and the owner was to say the name of the new object only 4 times, that was sufficient for them to learn the names of the 2 new objects and to remember it. So an incredibly quick way to learn the names of a new object. And so what they're saying here is that, like humans, dogs learn best in a social context. They're not saying the mechanism is the same, but I suppose the social construct is the same. And what they're very curious now about is whether these are learned traits in dogs or whether they are entirely genetic.
Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Lara Dungan, thanks very much. Now, ancient American civilizations have been a source of admiration and fascination over the centuries. And this is no less true of the Mayans, who on the one hand boasted some of the most sophisticated cultures of the pre-Columbian Americas with its art, architecture, mathematics, and astronomy. And on the other hand, like many early civilizations, they loved nothing more than a good old human sacrifice. But why did they do it? Dr. Holly Moyes is a professor of anthropology and heritage studies at the University of California. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Holly. You know, we haven't really talked about the Mayans ever on this show, so I'm really excited to talk about their civilization and what we've learned from digging up and exploring their remains. Tell me first about the Mayans. Who were they? When did they live? Where did they come from?
Well, the Maya people lived in Central America, so in what's today Guatemala, Belize, Mexico, parts of El Salvador and Honduras. And so they lived close to the equator. They were had a tropical adaptation, so everywhere along the equator, they practiced the same kinds of farming methods. So they practiced something called slash and burn farming, where you burn a little piece of the jungle off and then you grow, right? And so they grew corn, they grew beans, squash, chili peppers, those kinds of things. They were a very interesting people. They had a wonderful civilization, a high civilization, really. Some of the early states. And they lasted for about 2,000 years, which is probably more than we will at the rate we're going. So you have to really admire them for having a very stable civilization as well. They had, they lived in city-states, so they had these big, what we call them polities that were ruled by kings. So they had divine kingship, and they had a peasant class. They had sort of a middle class, a priest class as well. They built giant pyramids that were really impressive. In fact, their architecture is quite wonderful. They also built something called a corbelled arch. So they had these beautiful arches in their buildings. They practiced astronomy. They knew quite a lot about the stars. They could predict an eclipse. They had a writing system that was phonetic. And now we can read most of it. It had been lost, actually. And over the years, archaeologists put it back together.
It's really beautiful, that language. You can Google that or look at our Twitter page, twitter.com/newstalkscience, and you'll see some examples of this writing. It's really beautiful. I want to get almost immediately to this cave because it sounds like something from Indiana Jones. But before we do start to talk about human sacrifices, I want to first orient us in terms of the Incas and the Aztecs. Where do these guys sit in terms of geography and time?
Well, the Incas are in South America. So they're quite a ways away. And the Aztecs are so much later. They're hundreds of years later than the Maya. So the Olmec people were really some of the earliest high civilizations, and those were in Mexico, along the Atlantic coast in that area, but all through Mexico. So you had these early civilizations, and then the Maya sort of came up at the same time, but they didn't have divine kings until a little bit later than the Olmecs. So we see divine kingship coming along somewhere around 250 to 300 AD, and the Maya civilization at its height was around 600 to 700. That's when their populations were the highest and there were the most sites. It's also when they used caves the most.
Yeah, I just one question before we get to that. When you say divine kinship, that means that they believe that God chose a leader. That's the idea.
Yeah, just like the British.
Yeah, that's right.
It's really, every king is a divine king. Every king finds their sanctioned by God, and in some ways they represent God on earth, and it's hard to argue with their decisions.
Exactly, which is rather convenient, I think, if you're chosen as king. Do we know how they managed to maintain their control over the population, these kings? How do they get to assert their divinity, and how do they hold on to that? Is that written about in the Mayan culture?
Well, we do write about it. One of the ways is that they have bloodlines. I mean, this is really very similar to other kingships, other places, right, in Europe and stuff, but they have a bloodline. So
right, okay.
If you have that divine blood in your veins, and because this was so much part of the social system, I don't know how much challenge they ever really got. They fought with each other. They had endemic warfare, but you know, how they actually maintained the populace. They didn't have goons or anything. They didn't have a police force. So I don't know.
Interesting, isn't it? When you think about the, you know, haves and have nots, and one person just says, well, God chose me. And everyone goes, well, all right, you get to be king. We all serve you for the rest of our lives. It just seems, I mean, as an idea, it's amazing it took on in such with such popularity across the world. So,
you know, people today aren't religious necessarily. I mean, there are still a lot of religious people, but this was, they had a religion, and their religion was tied up with their politics and with their government, right? With the king. So he was also the head of their religion. So think about that, when you have an ideology like that to enforce it, you don't really need goons. You have deities.
And it is, of course, these deities that decide the future of the people beneath them. And so sometimes it's deemed that a god is angry or a god is happy, and behavior has to change within that community to favor blessings, right? So can you talk to us a little bit about this idea of sacrifice and this extraordinary cave that was found a number of years ago?
Okay, well, I love that you said that the people are beneath the deities, because in the Maya case, the deities are beneath the people because they're underground.
Right.
At least some of them, not all of them. So let me just talk about caves first, just a little bit. Because the Maya people, and in fact, caves everywhere, are, when you're talking about dark zones of caves, deep caves, not rock shelters where there's light and people could live there, but deep caves are always ritual spaces, always. People might go into them if they're in a warfare situation or they're hiding from somebody or some, you know, really extraneous condition. But for the most part, caves are ritual spaces. And for the Maya, this is true in spades, that this is where a lot of their deities are housed. And so there's a number of different ones that live in caves. There's the lords of the underworld, which are the lords of death, destruction, warfare, yeah, they disease. They can send all kinds of really bad things out. So they can come out of the cave, not the deities themselves, but they can send bad winds out to make people sick, and they can be responsible for your crops dying and all sorts of things like that. So you want to keep them happy. So you might leave offerings for them just to make sure they're okay. But there's also Chok the rain god that lives in a cave, and there's the maize god. So caves are also related with fertility, so rain and fertility. So at ATM, which is Aktuntunutilmeknal, which is the cave I think you're talking about, I did this cave for my master's thesis, and I was working with a project with a Belizean, who the PI was a Belizean named Jaime Awe, who I've worked with for many, many years, and I actually was trained for cave work on this particular cave. And so I recorded this cave back around 1997, 98. And the day after I finished recording it, they opened it for tourism, and you can actually go there. We left all the artifacts in place. There's a lot of stuff in this cave, so there's a lot of ceramics especially. But what I think what interests people the most about this cave is that there are people, there are skeletons deposited in this cave, and they're way back. So you have to walk through a river system to get to the cave or to get to the chamber. So you walk about 1500 meters. It's quite a distance.
Wow.
And then you have to climb up this rock, and then you have to go through this little tiny squeeze, and then it opens up into this big chamber, and that's where they were practicing these rituals. Most of it was during the what we call the late classic period, so somewhere between 700 and 900 AD. And there were things going on in the Maya area at that time that are very interesting. So I'm sure you've heard of the Maya collapse. And what that really means is that they didn't disappear. Everybody didn't die off. There are lots of Maya people around today. Many of them actually live in San Francisco, not too far from me. But there's Maya people everywhere in the United States and in Central America. There's a lot. So they haven't died out exactly, but their populations did drop during the late classic period dramatically, like a lot, maybe 95%.
Wow.
So all of these things were happening. They stopped building big buildings. They stopped writing. Everything kind of came to a halt during this time. And so it was right around the collapse, right before the collapse, that they're starting to use this cave, which is kind of an interesting thing.
Right. So the world is essentially ending for them in some way. We're not quite sure why, but 95% of the population disappear over a short period of time. And that coincides with what appear to be human sacrifices within the cave. What science have we done to confirm that hypothesis that they are sacrifices? Could we possibly know that? And what sort of research is done in these caves on these individuals?
Okay, so this is a really controversial topic.
It's anthropology. I'm well used to it.
Yeah, archaeologists really argue about this. So there's some people who really don't believe that the Maya did sacrifice at all,
right?
Which is interesting, because I think most Maya archaeologists know that they did, or think that they did, because of the condition that we find different kinds of skeletons. And but what's interesting is, we really don't see very much human sacrifice among the Maya. It's actually rather rare. And a lot of the best images are actually drawings. They're from the iconography. So we see pictures of human sacrifice. And then they found in Mexico, there's sacrificial victims in the cenotes. There's some ethnographic records of human sacrifice. So we're fairly sure they did it. But from what I can tell so far, with the caves, is that it appears that they really weren't practicing human sacrifice in caves until the late classic period, which is also interesting. So prior to this time, it looks like they were just going in, singing, dancing, bringing artifacts in, pottery especially. And so you see those kind of ritual behaviors, but you really don't see people until the late classic. Now, can I prove that? I'm thinking of this from the perspective that we're dating these things by the ceramics that surround them.
Right.
But we can't, directly dating the bones is very, very difficult.
Why?
And to prove, because they're so degraded. So one of the things that they like to do in every cave I've worked in so far that has human remains in it, and that would be maybe 5 or 6. I mean, they don't all. In fact, most of them don't. But the ones I have seen, they're all in water. They deposited these bodies in wet areas so that the bones have degraded a lot. You can't tell a whole lot about them. We can sometimes determine the sex. We can determine that it's a whole person because it's pretty much all there. But a lot of the collagen and it's just completely gone. So there's all kinds of things we'd like to be able to do with these bones. And I have things that are in the lab right now that they're working on, but they're having a really hard time directly dating them.
You say that you can determine the sex of these victims, of these skeletons. Were they of a particular type? Were sacrifices a particular type of person or gender?
Well, a lot of this is actually modeled on the Aztecs, because they did human sacrifice in spades. And
yeah.
There was a lot written about it, and we even know where some of the victims came from. And you know, they're not all victims. Some of them may have been volunteers. The Aztecs had volunteers, but they also they sacrificed slaves, war captives, babies, people who were disenfranchised in some way. So
right.
If they were sold into slavery, gamblers, prostitutes, right? So we kind of use those models to think about the Maya as well, but that's not necessarily accurate. But I can tell you that at Achtuntun and Chilmacnol, we have a lot of different kinds of people. We have some adult males that could be war captives. We don't really know. We have at least one adult female. We have some adolescents, and we have quite a few babies. And babies for the Aztec were the quintessential sacrifice for the rain deities,
right?
And the Aztecs did some pretty amazing things. They would get little kids, they like 2-year-olds, and they would pinch them to make them cry, because the tears were sympathetic magic to make it rain,
right?
So for whatever reason, children were kind of the offering par excellence.
So what makes you think in this cave that extends to 1.5 kilometers with rivers flowing through it, really does sound like something from Indiana Jones. What makes you think these skeletons are a sacrifice? Could they not have been someone who just starved there? Is there any evidence of trauma to the head, or are they dressed in a clothing that might be decorative, that might indicate it?
Part of the argument is what we're not finding.
Right.
So we're not finding things like grave goods. So, I mean, it's possible that they could have brought people in there to bury them in some specific way. None of these people are buried. They're all interred on the surface. So they're all right on the surface. There would be nowhere to bury them in the cave because there's not a dirt in the cave, right? There's no soils really to bury them.
It's rock, yeah.
It's rock, yeah. And a lot of the bones, like I said, are highly degraded. Some of them are covered in calcite. And so what happens is when you put a person in a pool of water, especially if it's an intermittent pool where it fills up and then it drains out, it leaves this calcite crust, kind of like what is on your teapot, right? So it leaves the same kind of crust on the skeleton. Now, the problem is, in order to actually excavate that, you'd have to break the crust, and it's a non-renewable resource. And right now, the one that we're probably maybe the most interested in is the one that was originally sexed as a woman. She's an adult. She's called the Crystal Sepulcher. So she's covered in beautiful calcite crystal, and she's a huge tourist attraction. You know, people go to the cave to see her. So we can't really disrupt this without making a huge mess of it, you know, because it's like Humpty Dumpty. Once you break it off, you can't really put it back on. So there's certain kinds of analyses we might be able to do on some of these skeletons. They've all been sexed, or at least most of them. The babies we can't, they're too small. But the other thing is, think about it, like a baby's going to crawl in a cave. I mean, they need to be taken in, right?
Yeah.
And also the positioning, where they are, they're all in these pools. They're in these little pools. So you'll find 4 or 5 babies in a little pool, you know, stuck underneath like an overhang.
Yeah.
So they're also in these crevices and things. So part of it is because it's so hard to get to. It's way in the back of the cave. It's clearly intentional. And there's no grave goods. And the woman I was talking about in the Crystal Sepulcher, it looks as if she was just thrown down and her arm landed in back of her head. So she's akimbo. She's not in a respectful burial position. And I would say of all the places in Belize that we know of that have human remains, this is the one people argue the least about as being human sacrifice. In fact, almost even the people who don't really think that these people were sacrificed have to say that this is the hardest case to argue against it.
Okay. Do you, as an anthropologist and archaeologist, find it frustrating to come across something that is so rich and yet you can't touch it? It's like it's so close and yet it's infinitely far away. If you could duplicate it perfectly, atom for atom, wouldn't you love to lift it out and put it into the scanner and do all sorts of sample testing on it? Is that not really frustrating that you have to look at it and just guess from your visual observations and understandings of the history and culture?
Yes, but the good news about archaeology is that we're always developing new techniques to look at things and to get information. So just because we can't get the information now, you know, I'm happy that the cave is curated and that I'm glad people can go in and see it because it's very moving and it's very exciting and it makes people more
I want to go to there.
Right, of course you do. It's one of the seven wonders of the world. It's somewhere you definitely want to go to because it's so amazing. So in a sense, yeah, it's frustrating, but there's so many things in archaeology that we can gather data on, but that we might not ever know, or we might know in the future. And so that's the other good news, is that there's all kinds of things that we can do now that we couldn't do 50 years ago or even 20 years ago. So, you know, sometimes you just have to be patient and wait and think about archaeological time.
Well, it's good that you're doing that job and not me. I'm not a very patient person. I would really find that very frustrating, hence the question. Really fascinating work you're involved in. Dr. Holly Moyes, Professor of Anthropology and Heritage Studies at University of California. Thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you so much for having me here and for your interest.
I've never been to Central America, but that sounds like one of those places you need to go before you die, doesn't it? It sounds so cool. Have you ever been to Belize, Aidan?
I haven't, no. Well, I've been to Central America. I've been to the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, which I guess is the north end of Central America.
Is that where the crater was supposed to have hit?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And there's actually, I wish I knew the name of them now. There's these sort of, there's a special kind of local name for them, but what essentially they are like caves with like lakes at the bottom of them, like they go straight down, as opposed to you'd expect a cave to, I suppose, go kind of across. And they apparently are all remnants of the big asteroid hit.
Sort of karst formations, are they?
They're actually kind of like little, like if you, I guess, had a droplet of rain and then all the beads popped off and knocked the bit, like, hang on, how would I explain this? Not very
what
well.
What are you talking about?
So it's like you have the big crater.
You might have been smoking a little bit of the Yucatan stuff, the Yucatan cactus before you went on that tour.
That is a lesson in science communication, people. Think about what your analogy is going to be before you just start talking shit like I did. Basically, there are holes with water in them that are beautiful and they're caused by this thing. That's all you need to know.
Right. Okay. Awesome. Thanks for that. He produces this science program, would you believe?
It's been a long day.
As you can hear, producer Aidan McKelvey joins us to go through some of the comments we got from last week, your texts and emails. Someone says, science communication, we're talking about communications during the pandemic and why science communicators weren't really involved as much as perhaps they should have been, knowing what they know about how to communicate these things, explain risk and so on. We got one text saying science communication in relation to COVID has been really poor. Essentially, COVID is a serious and fatal form of pneumonia. People know what pneumonia is, but it was never explained to the public this way. Well, I mean, obviously, we're talking about communicating clearly. Pneumonia is a bacterial thing. COVID-19 is a virus, but certainly in the symptoms, it's similar, but it's not that simple. I mean, people would say, well, that's not the same. And of course, you can have COVID-19 and then you can develop pneumonia, can't you, from COVID-19? So like, I don't know, like it's not that simple to communicate it, I don't think.
Yeah, it's probably not the best thing as well to be equating slightly different things. It gives an in to the doubters, you know, to say, oh, well, it's just this, you know, it's only a flu, or it's the same. My auntie had pneumonia and she's grand, or whatever.
And also, a pneumonia is fatal to many people every year. So, look, I take your point. We certainly could have done better, but I'm not sure that actually improved the situation. No offense. Joan says, how naive am I? All along, I presume they had behavioral psychologists involved in the communication strategy for COVID. They did, not in all countries, but yeah, I believe Pete Lunn advised an effort, but whether or not they take on the recommendations or really fully got on board with this idea of behavioral psychology is another question. Another text says, we generally get one-sided science propaganda from News Talk. Again, that sounds like two sentences mixed into one. I'm not quite sure what you're saying. I like to get multiple information sources and make my own informed decisions that I'm comfortable with. That's why I find it so clear to see how bought and paid for and downright dangerous someone like, there's a scientist's name here, I won't name for defamation reasons, News Talk and the Irish media are so obviously bought and paid for, or just blindly brainwashed. What's wrong with getting a braid, happens in the broad view of things. A, this lady seems decent enough. However, I think she's talking about Samantha Yameen, who was talking about science communication. Vaccine hesitancy is extremely smart, in my opinion. Why would I take something blindly without doing my research? Just to talk very briefly on this, obviously, I understand why people don't want to take something if they don't understand what it is and they don't trust those sources. I think if you don't trust the sources you're getting the information from, then I can understand why people be hesitant about vaccines. But we've said many times in the program, vaccines, in the most part, are extremely safe, but there are some people who have negative reactions. This vaccine has come along much quicker, but it has gone through the testing that the health organizations, the people who govern the countries and govern these regulations, believe that it's safe and efficacious, and not always and not for everyone, as we're seeing with AstraZeneca. But the thing about getting your information from lots of different sources is that you could never research enough to really know. Isn't that right, Aidan? We talked about this before, that you can never really know anything unless you witness it yourself. And even then, it's tricky, right? When it comes to what we actually know, it's actually, we don't know anything. We believe what we're told by other people.
Yeah, unless you're an expert, like you're not going to do the primary source research on essentially anything in your entire life. And if you take a philosophical approach to it, sure, it's good to do your research, but how do you weigh the research? So, you know, when you don't know the facts, it's fine to be skeptical. But if you're going to be skeptical, you need to ask yourself, how many people are saying this thing? And then who are the people who are saying that thing? And are they qualified to say it? So it's not like you look at 100 articles and 60 of them say that the vaccine is some sort of conspiracy or some sort of fraud. Who are those 60 people? Why have you selected this particular 100 people?
Yeah, why do you believe them?
Exactly. Why do you believe
them? Why do you believe them over?
Like, the fundamental thing is the vast majority of people, and I'm not at all denying that I'm sure there are some people who disagree on this fact, but I'm not an immunologist. And the vast majority of immunologists.
Wait, saying some people would disagree that you're not an immunologist.
Some people might. Like, I'm not an immunologist, and I'm sure there are some immunologists maybe who disagree with some other things. I've no idea. But the vast majority of immunologists think, you know, coronavirus is happening, the vaccines are safe, and they know what they're talking about better than you or I or Jonathan. I can write an article on the internet saying anything. It doesn't necessarily mean it has any weight or value. I could write you a good article about recorded music, which is something I know about, but I couldn't write you a good article about immunology because I don't know anything about it. I get it secondhand.
I guess my point was going one step further to say that even those scientists have to take the word of others to come to a conclusion. A scientist has to take the word of the person who creates the pipettes, that it's doing its job correctly, of the software that it runs it through, that that's doing the correct job and giving the right answers. Like, no one individual can fully understand a vaccine at all. Like, there's the manufacturer of it, there's the research of it, there's the microbiology, there's the storage of it, all the things that you have to, in this world, you have to lean on other people's expertise to navigate the world. There's not one immunologist in the world who can tell you exactly how the vaccine was created, how it works, how it's made, and how it's going to be distributed. Nobody can do that. And so you have to look at who do I trust to make a shorthand of not having to learn all that information. And it comes down to you not trusting sources that maybe have a history of being trustworthy, and you trusting sources that perhaps don't.
Yeah, like if you've an issue with your plumbing at home, you don't go to your father-in-law. Oh, my father-in-law saw this thing on YouTube that you don't need to do anything with that. You'd probably ask a plumber, because they know about it.
If you agree that you need to get information from somewhere, it then comes down to how do you vet your choices. And I always look at, like, who's saying this and who's in with the other guys. Like, if you're on board with Alex Jones, and if he's quoting the same people that you're, then you have to go, wait a second, am I with him? Another text on Samantha Yameen. She said, you know, if she wants to, you know, gauge a scientist's, you know, credibility and their work, she looks at a scientist's last 5 published papers for their integrity. And Nick says, even though it's used as a measure, it's total bullshit nowadays, as published papers are paid for to be published. Payment for anything has to be a problem for integrity in science. Look, you're right in that the publishing model for science is hugely problematic, and positive results being favored over negative results, hugely problematic. Targets of papers to be published by scientists every year, to metrics, all of these things are really problematic. But I think it's probably unfair to say papers are paid for, but Bad Science by Ben Goldacre really did open my eyes to a world of big questions about how we go about making medicines. Have you read that, Aidan?
I haven't actually, no.
Yeah. Oh, you've got to read it. When you start to read it and you go, oh man, this isn't good.
Yeah, but like,
it documents pretty well, not only the sort of lies and cover-ups that have happened, but also this awful waste that goes into, you know, not publicly publishing every paper that is publicly funded. That makes no sense to me, but is still the default, and it's mind-boggling.
Oh yeah, this is when people, they don't get a result, or they don't publish their negative results. Is that?
Well, they don't publish their negative results, but also you can be publicly funded for research, but then that paper is published in Nature or Science, which is a paywall, and so the public can't read the science that they paid for. And that to me is problematic.
Yeah,
and to a lot of people. Yeah. All right. Well, that's it from us for this week. Thanks to the production team. They were Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mulhall, and Steve Daunt. Steve McLoon was on sound. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. A really great episode with Kit Chapman. He's going to be talking about super heavy elements and the amazing capers scientists have gotten up to trying to discover these and put their name on Mendeleev's list. That's next Tuesday. We'll be more Future Proof proper on Saturday. In the meantime, stay curious.